for the next couple of sessions. Today I want to finish up a little bit of unfinished business from the previous lecture, even though, again, you do have the lecture notes. I think it will be useful for me to quickly run through the set of what I was calling steps in the construction of a Marxist concept of class, just so that kind of roadmap of the logic of the categories are clear. We'll then spend spend the rest of today and Monday on the concept of exploitation. And we will do this by today having it be a full lecture for the entire time, but with discussion as we go. And on Monday, finishing up the lecture and then having more time for discussion, where we will again have at least part of that time be in small groups and part of the time in our larger groups. So let me just finish up the discussion of what is class by going through the step-by-step guide to building the concept, the Marxian concept of class, and giving it its specificity. The first step was that this is a relational concept rather than a gradational one. The second step was giving some content to the particular kind of relation, which means distinguishing it from other sorts of relations, gender and race being examples. And for that, we need to locate the concept of class relations within the problem of production. And within the problem of production, we have to understand class relations as distinct from the purely technical relations of production. Cynthia and Lindsay. So now we're at step three. One of the central features of Marxian concepts of class, as opposed to most others, is the idea that there are qualitatively different kinds of class relations. That class relations do not apply only to capitalism, that there are a variety of different sorts of class relations in the history of the world. And that to understand the specificity of a particular kind of class relation, part of what you're doing is differentiating it from other kinds of class relations. Now, this is quite different, for example, from Weber. In Weber, really, classes only exist in his way of thinking about the problem within market economies, and properly only within capitalist market economies. He doesn't make an entirely sharp distinction between market economies and capitalist market economies, but mostly he does. But for Marx, that isn't the case. And therefore, we need to really understand what the specificity of different kinds of class relations are. Now, this is different. For example, if you have a gradational notion of class where there's upper, middle, and lower, you can talk about the upper, middle, and lower class of ancient Rome, the upper, middle, and lower class of the French regime on the eve of the French Revolution, and the upper, middle, and lower class in the world today, right? But clearly the meanings become totally different. You're using the same words, but you're talking about different phenomena. The Marxist view is, no, you should have distinct kinds of class relations for different sorts of societies. The clearest example, I think, would be slavery versus capitalism. So in slavery, the central class relation is between slave owners and slaves. In capitalism, it's between capitalists and workers. Now, what is the most decisive difference between those? There's lots of differences between slave economies and capitalist economies, between slave relations and capitalist relations. But what's the single most decisive feature of a slave class relation that is absent in a capitalist class relation, which renders them really different sorts of phenomena?
Personal relations.
Yeah, free labor is the way you describe it from the capitalist point of view. Owning people as assets that you can own in a slave context. So one way of thinking about the difference of variations across class systems is that in all class systems, remember going back to the definition of class relations as a particular type of production relation, in all class relations, the various assets used in production are owned differentially by different actors within production. The rights and powers over assets are unequally distributed. We can then distinguish class relations in part on the basis of what's ownable and what's not ownable. In capitalism, people are not ownable. You cannot buy and sell people in a capitalist economy. That particular asset has been, so to speak, redistributed in a radically egalitarian way. I like this way of describing the contrast between capitalism and slavery, because it contains the intuition about what it is that makes capitalism, in some ways, a very radical... Gary?
No, you're...
Adam, sorry. And Jorge. Okay, is it? Daniel Suarez isn't here yet, and Gary isn't here yet. Okay. So one way of thinking about what happens when slavery is destroyed, we have a radical egalitarian redistribution of one asset. Everybody's allowed to own one and only one person, themselves. The word own has to be put in quotes there because it's a peculiar kind of self-ownership since you can't sell yourself into slavery. Property rights in people have been drastically transformed. But other kinds of ownership remain dramatically equal. It's perfectly fine in capitalism to own zero means of production, or to have vast wealth. No problem at all. In slavery, people can own people, in capitalism they can't. And that's how we would distinguish between these different kinds of class relations. That's step three, specifying variations, yeah.
I was just wondering if maybe you could use another step in between, one, maybe two and three or something, which is at least, which seems Marxist to me, which is to insist on class as a historical concept, i.e. class societies only exist after human society is able to produce a social surplus product. And class societies afterwards defines the struggle over that surplus product.
So this is an interesting issue in the logic of constructing a concept. So that claim is certainly an important one within Marxism. That is that classes emerge historically at a particular point, and that there are certain preconditions necessary before you can have classes. And particularly, there has to be a system of production in place already in which it's possible to appropriate a surplus, right? Some version, something close to that. Now the question is that a part of the, does that enter in early in the analysis, or is that something which is a discovery once you've mapped variations and specified the concept, and then you discover, aha, isn't this interesting? This can only happen under certain conditions, right? I would prefer the historical aspect to come later in the account. Doesn't make it less important. It's just that more presuppositions are needed before we get to that point. I haven't, for example, yet defined exploitation. That comes in later. Some of these steps are housekeeping steps. They're just defining concepts. Others have more of a kind of logical character that you need to understand one thing before you can really pose another. I like to, my move on these grounds is I like to think of the categories in their first elaboration not as historical categories in the first instance, but as logical categories that have a conceptual coherence. And then it's discoveries about how the world works using those concepts that we understand their historical specificity. So I wouldn't define capitalism as something that comes after feudalism, for example. It's a discovery about the world that feudal class relations break down in ways that are generated by the emergence inside of feudal societies of capitalism, and that historicizing of it makes sense from the historical record. But we need the conceptual apparatus before we can make sense of it. But you could do it the other way, and there's good arguments for having building the concepts themselves be driven more by historical argument, and then discovering, well, what was it about these early societies that rendered it possible to have class relations, and then maybe only introducing the notion of exploitation at that point. Step four is just a question of clarifying. Yeah, Tarfan?
I was just wondering if, because we define just a class like any social division based on material or economic conditions of life, right? Which is related with inequality.
Well, that is the most general definition that would include non-Marxian notions as well. The Marxian ones wouldn't just say any economic division that in material conditions of life.
One division which involves exploitation or...
No, I think step 2B in my list, which is class relations are relations, not just divisions, they're relations that are built around unequal rights and powers over the assets that are used in production. So it's over assets, it's control over the inputs into production that are the pivot for understanding class, not inequalities in the outcomes of production. So the inequalities in the outcome of production are the consequences of having class relations. The inequalities in the control over the inputs are what render them class relations as opposed to some other kind of inequality. And that's an aspect, by the way, which Marx and Weber share pretty much. There's some distinctions, but Weber also really has a asset-based concept of class rather than an outcome-based concept of class. Okay, then step four, this is more housekeeping in the sense of just clarifying some language we'll use. I want to distinguish class, the idea of class relations from class locations. The expression class location defines the places that are occupied by people. So real flesh and blood persons in the world occupy locations within relations. And the word class location refers to those locations. The term class structure, this I didn't put into this inventory of steps, but the term class structure applies to the total structure of the relations and the locations which they generate. Step five is to recognize that class concepts and class analysis occur both, here's where class structure comes in, I'm sorry. Where class analysis occurs at both micro and macro levels of analysis. That class is applied at both the micro and the macro. We will discuss that contrast between micro and macro and exactly what's in play there. We'll discuss that in the most focused way when we get to the problem of ideology and consciousness. That's the domain in Marxian accounts, I think, where there's the most interesting problem of how to link micro and macro accounts. The macro concept of class analysis is class structure, which is the totality of class relations within any unit of analysis you might want to study. So you can talk about the class structure of an individual firm, the class structure of a city, the class structure of a country. You can talk about the class structure of the world. Any macro unit of analysis, you can ask the question, what is the nature of the class relations and how are they distributed and organized within that unit of analysis? The notion of class structure, therefore, is always a macro unit. The micro analysis of class has to do with the impact of those macro structures on the lives of persons that live within those relations. People live within relations, and that has consequences for your life. And in particular, in Marxist class analysis, but not only, there are two kinds of consequences which are the central concern at the micro level. And these I refer to as experiences and interests. There are two ways that we think about the consequences at the micro level of being in a class relation. One is in terms of the experiences you have, and the other is in terms of the interests you have. Experience refers to the things that happen to you by virtue of being in the class relation. Interests refers to what you have to do to meet your material needs because of your class position. Interests refers to what you have to do given your class location in order to meet your material needs. Experience refers to things that happen to you by virtue of being in there. So, just as examples, getting fired from a job is an experience that happens to people by virtue of being in a working class location. Being told you're not working hard enough and getting yelled at by a foreman is something that happens to you. It's an experience. It affects your life through the ways it impacts on you. Deciding you need to get more education, joining a union, looking at deciding you need to move to a different city, these are all things that you have to do in order to meet your material needs if you're in particular kinds of working class positions, if you're in a labor market. And your interests are defined by the strategies you need to adopt to meet your material needs. The things that happen to you determine your experiences, and the two are connected because your ability to act on your interests may depend heavily upon the nature of your experiences. Again, when we discuss the problem of ideology and culture and consciousness, that will be the cluster of the issue. How do we think about the connection between experience and interests? Yeah?
Yeah, I was going to ask, are you only limiting this micro class analysis only to material interests? And you just said that you're going to...
I think the primary focus of the class character of experience is around material experiences that one have in one's material existence and the interests one have materially. But of course, it ramifies to all other aspects of life. Right? So it's not the case that by virtue of being in the working class, the only experiences you have are economic experiences, but the class content of those experiences are the material ones. You may also have gender experiences and cultural experiences, all sorts of other things happen to you by virtue of those material realities. But I don't want to fold all of that into the concept of class. I want to keep the concept of class focused on these particular mechanisms. What happens to you when you're inserted into those social relations by virtue of being there? Matt and then Daniel.
So class relations can be analyzed on a micro or on a macro level, is that right? And class structure is solely a macro variable. Okay, thanks.
I want to know sort of what you mean by what you must do to meet material needs given a classification. Is that sort of implying that there is an objective things that you should do? Or are these must as in, like, for example, like joining a union? I mean, like, are these things that one does do or one that should do?
Okay.
Or
this is a, that's actually an extremely deep question.
Okay.
Right. No, not sorry. You should pat yourself on the back for innocently asking a really hard question. The question of whether the interests that we specify through class relations are objective, that is, do they really exist in the world to be discovered by people, or are they just preferences? Are they just what people think about? Now, it's certainly not the case that everyone who's in the working class acknowledges the fact that their material interests would be advantaged if they formed solidarity communities with other workers. Many workers don't believe that. They say, nonsense. I'm a rugged individualist. The way to make your way in the world is to compete and fight with other people and to figure out clever ways of improving your community. I think it's most productive to treat as a working way of approaching these problems that there are objective interests to be discovered, not just subjective interests, that people can have incorrect views about what's in their interests. But then we have to be very careful about precisely what that means, to have an incorrect view about their interests. An incorrect view about your interest in joining with unions would be the belief, an incorrect view would be the, if you're in the working class, it would be the belief